myself, so I'll go ahead and start. My name is Carlene George. I have a BS from BYU, a master's from Chapman College. Is that better? Okay. My name is Carlene George. I'm the moderator. Hi, Alan. I have a BS from BYU, a master's from Chapman College. I'm a survivor of long-hood prolonged child trauma. I'm a traveler fighting for a path to stay alive through a thick forest of clinical depression. I am continually learning how to deal with, for 21 years, how to facilitate the healing of hundreds of youth, giving them hope, enabling them, and not enabling them, teaching them employability and life skills, acceptance, love, and when I'm very lucky, I get to give them a moral compass at Clearfield Job Corps. I'm the mother of three grown children. I'm in the process of adopting a previous Job Corps student who was raised in an orphanage in Russia. The good, the bad, and the ugly. My church court was initiated by my bishop as a result of my request to have my name removed from the church records. This was in 1989. The experience left me feeling exploited. It was not sin that caused me to end up in church court, and yet I felt afterwards that I certainly was a sinner. Now, my upbringing ensured that I was a good and obedient model Mormon. My mother tried to help us be perfect Mormons, and she was very overly concerned with appearances. But behind closed doors, things were not so perfect. Our home was deep in Mormon thought, tradition, and fables. We fought a lot. There were power struggles to be heard and to get approval and to do what was correct. But our family nights were Monday night at the fights. I tried my best and naively believed that conforming perfectly would bring me great happiness. As a result, my activity in the LDS church was mostly on task. In my formative years, I lived in Southern California. And boy, that was great. I loved those years. Dance festivals, sing-alongs, early morning seminary, active camp crafter program, institute, young adult program. I had great happiness. I was very happy in the church. I was very active in the church. I had increased joy. And I had just tons of friends. It was an amazing time of my life. In the early 70s, I went to a mission in Ireland. I had determined when I was 7 years old, when I first found out that girls can go on missions, which I had never known before that moment, that I was going to go on a mission. I went to Ireland, and my mission president was President Summer Hayes. He was a very loving and gentle person, and he showed unconditional love. That was a really new experience for me. I knocked on thousands of Catholic doors. I misjudged the Catholic Church, thinking that the LDS Church was the only true church, and that the Catholic Church was the great and abominable church. In spite of myself, I grew with the time and the knowledge of the scriptures, and I recognized President Summer Hayes' love for me. Now, there are two things I gained on my mission. One thing is I learned to endure. Endure much, endure long, endure being cold, endure each day, endure. Because in time, I know that things will eventually pass. We spent 60 to 70 hours mostly tracking a week. We taught very few people. We lived in very substantial circumstances. I was always wet and cold, and I gained a strength and ability to endure one day at a time. This has served me very well in life, for life has often required for me to endure. I have often also heard in my family the great sacrifice that my great-grandmother affectionately called Mutti made when she immigrated from Germany after she was baptized. They were told to moved to Utah to strengthen the church. As she was advised in 1907, she left her family to never see them again, came to America for a life of struggle, settled in West Salt Lake, lost a baby boy on arrival, lived an industrious life, stayed faithful, cried herself to sleep for years, learned English from her children who attended school, stayed close to her German friends in Cannon Ward on the west side, and died at 99. I have felt it is my heritage to honor her sacrifice. I was married in 1976. My husband joined the Air Force in 79. We were eventually transferred to Fairchild Air Force Base. I gave birth to 3 daughters. I did find motherhood fulfilling, but my belief in the happily ever after began to fade. I was becoming disillusioned with the promise of the church. The belief of my upcoming was beginning to fail me. Work hard, live the commandments, and ye shall be happy. That scripture that spoke of great joy, the more obedient you became, just did not seem to be working out. I tried harder with great obedience, but I felt no joy. Why not? Apparently, I was not good enough. I recall the deep pain I had from attending church. I remember primary lessons about little boys who prayed to find their truck, and they would find their truck. And yet, I was not good enough to be protected from sexual predators at the age of 4 and 5. I remember the young woman's lesson of how a fine young man would never want a damaged woman. Well, I certainly wouldn't qualify for a fine young man. In 82, I was in a dysfunctional marriage, had 3 small children, undiagnosed clinical depression, PTSD, and I always came up short. I felt very invisible to God. I began to recognize myself as a very toxic Mormon. I was full of judgment of those and judged those and measured them by my measuring stick and felt they came up short too. We moved to Vandenberg Air Force Base in 1984. I had reached a breaking point at Vandenberg in California. Care for my children consisted of keeping myself and my children alive at the end of the day. I was continually discontent from the world around me. Only my youngest daughter kept me tied to this world. But I was tortured by voices in my head. My memory had deteriorated and my depression deepened. I had made a couple serious attempts on my life. It was not long before I had a plan to commit suicide and take my youngest daughter with me, for I could emotionally detach myself from everybody on the earth except her. But before I gave in to this plan, I did a last-ditch effort to see a base hospital doctor. He made it clear I would be transported to a psychiatric hospital in Santa Barbara. I decided, why not get a priesthood blessing? You know, might as well. I'm in so much pain. What could it hurt? The home teachers came up to the base hospital. The spirit emanated from them as if they were Jedi Knights. It trailed after them as they walked in the room. The power of God was there. I felt it seeping through the cracks, under the doors, as if a mist was escaping from the room. There was no doubt of the power that walked in the room that day. The words of the blessing tumbled out of their mouths, a promise from God repeated over and over. I would never, ever be alone again. I would always have someone there. He would guide them to me. I would never be alone. Tears flowed from all presence. This was a promise from God that I felt He would never break. I had stopped before I made a decision of great self-harm. This experience had the cells in my body responding to the light in the room. not the visible light, but the light of Christ. More tears flowed, and again the promise was reassured, I would never be alone again. I did not fully understand what that really meant, but I had no doubt that that promise would be kept, and I had no doubt of the strength and power of the Spirit in the room that day. Well, we moved to Kaysville, and my husband, when he was transferred to Hill Air Force Base, that's when I discovered Sunstone. What a treasure it was. My first session was titled, Have Enough Faith to Doubt. Perfect first session for me to go to. I was there for September 6th, Olive Branch, White Rose Campaign, and Sunstone was there for me. I listened to other people's stories who had been hurt by the church, or members of the church, or leaders of the church, and I could speak openly about my pain. I also spoke to people about their healing. I received, Sunstone brought me Exponent 2, Pilgrimage, Mormon Women's Forum, and I now had women in my life who did not judge me, even when I did something wrong, even when I got something very wrong. This has brought me freedom, but I still felt very conflicted. In 89, I asked to have my name removed. I had to send a letter to the church office building before my bishop took my request seriously. He said my name could not be removed until they had a church court to determine my worthiness. They don't do it that way now. I took a deep breath and considered it my moral obligation to attend. I stated that my primary reason for my request was due to the fact that I had an extremely active mother. I felt I had excelled in the church to gain her pleasure. My mother and the LDS church had become so entwined, I could not tell the difference between them. Church court came. I was seeking withdrawal from membership. I was questioned in detail about my past sins. Some of the questions were extremely inappropriate about some of my past behavior. Ultimately, I was disfellowshipped. They told me to remove my garments, and they sent me a letter of requirements to come back into the fold. I burned the letter. I did not even read what I needed to do to come back into the fold. When I left the building after the church court, I went to the parking lot, smoked several cigarettes, left the bus in the parking lot, and vowed that membership in the church was not for me. It only added to my pain of rejection and the feeling that I was not good enough. The church had ignored my request to have my name removed. I felt disgusted by the church leaders that had held the court. After the church court, I decided that if I ever needed to have absolution for my sins, I would attend a Catholic confession box and do it that way. I also decided that I would accept disfellowshipment as okay with me, because now I could go out and sin and still have the gift of the Holy Ghost. In an ironic way, this court freed me. I was no longer bound by the experience of the past. I did not have a predetermined path that I had to follow. I was no longer required to be a model Mormon. My course was now mine. I was free, and I did rebel. In 91, the military transferred us to Mountain Home. We stayed there for 2 years. This was a turning point for several reasons. For my mental state, of my childhood healing, and the realization of God's promise to me. I also began to see church as a path to Christianity, and I also received 3 tattoos in Idaho. In Mountain Home, I felt prompted to move to a certain street. There I made a lifetime friend, Cindy Tereskevich, a Catholic with a wide open heart. She has become a lifetime friend. I was also guided to a loving and gifted therapist, Gordon Smith. He made a commitment that he would work with me as long as he was able, and he did for 23 years. Even after he retired, he would still have appointments with me. He never quit on me. He returned all my phone calls. He guided me to trust people on a level I had never trusted before. He heard my stories of pain. I had a level of safety with him that I had never felt before. The therapy was extremely intense and very painful. I still had a death wish, and I still found myself into psychiatric wards, but I improved. Gordon passed away after a stroke last month. I did get to visit with him, fortunately, the day before he had his stroke. I have felt pain at his loss, knowing that I was guided to him in my life. Concerning church, I would attend the LDS military wards. I like LDS military wards. The population of the military people seem to accept me quickly, and they have a larger world view. The Sunday service that I attended the most at this base, though, was a non-denominational service. I even took my daughters to it. They assisted me in becoming closer to Christ. For it was Christ was used as the measuring stick in the service, not a bunch of rules. The meaning of the meeting was to come together for a purpose, to love and support each other, not for the purpose of showmanship. I was prompted just a few days before my husband came home and informed me that he was transferred to a remote base in South Korea. On the same day, I received a phone call from my husband, from my father, that his cancer had returned. The decision was made. I would return to Utah to be with my father with my three daughters. There, I found people who did not judge me by my church standing. I found people who liked me for who I was. I was glad to be able to return to Sunstone. I spent time with my father, who was a loving Christian, who accepted me and who was a quiet, gentle man. In time, I lost my father, ended my marriage here, and returned to the church here. I was guided to the home to purchase when I stepped over the threshold. The Relief Society president came to my door and asked what she could do to help. I stated my husband, now deployed to Korea for a year, was the major cook of the home, so I would need meals brought in for the next year. She laughed. She caught the irony. Upon meeting Bishop Greg Garfield, his demeanor was relaxed, open, un-Mormon-like, and very accepting. His posture was casual, and I felt his genuine concern. After a few months, he came and offered to pay for phone calls to Korea if it would help me manage my family. He really had thought this offer through. I responded that I was fine, even though I was not attending church. His response was, "I would never judge how you are doing by your attendance at church." That moved me inside. He would never judge how I was doing by my attendance at church. This message was so different from the way I was raised. It was the polar opposite. I questioned in my mind if I had heard him correctly. I repeated his response in my head until it encompassed my heart. This moved something very small inside of me. My heart began to thaw. He had the ward records. He saw I was defellowshipped. He never asked me about it. It did not seem to concern him, and I felt no shame. Again, the promise was kept, and I knew it. The promise of never being alone again, and the promise now took on a new meaning and depth. I was becoming surrounded by more and more people who accepted me, loved me unconditionally, laughed with me, who wanted me in their lives. The church was not formed as a use of judgment or shame. Thus, I did not feel so alone. The people that God had led me to were caring, intelligent, and had a quick wit. As my father's health deteriorated, the bishop became a listening ear. Just over 1 year had passed since we had moved there, and my father passed away. My friend, a true Christian. I plunged into a deep darkness. I doubted that there was even a God. I became deeply sad. My mind collapsed. Bishop Garfield continued to be a kind and intelligent and responsive person. The church was never a matter of our discussions. I slowly came up for air and stayed in touch with Bishop Garfield. Later, when I shared with him that my marriage was ending, he did not call us in to try to fix or save the eternal marriage. He just extended his hand and shook my hand and hoped me the best in my future path. I also met another lifetime friend named Cindy Brewer. Their whole family has taken me in, and they have been unwavering in their friendship and acceptance of me. God had kept his promise to me. Later on, Cindy shared with me that they were prompted to buy that home in the ward boundaries. And that when she saw me at church for the first time, I was hanging out in the foyer because I was not sure I really wanted to be there. And she heard a voice. She is why you bought that house. So thank you, Brewers and the Garfields. And then again, the voice. It's time to get ready to move. So I moved to a condo in Roy after much looking. And there again, I found people who got me. Alan Hall, Susan Sherman, and others. That would be another paper, but I'll leave it at that. More people who got me. I have had members judge me, make comments about my lack of faith to heal myself, show service to me that I did not even deserve, whisper behind my back about my bad behavior, question my motives, not trust my story, and question my worthiness. Am I active in the LDS church now? I don't attend church currently. My job prevents me from doing that. I don't know how that will change when I am no longer employed at my current employer. My current stake president, who was my bishop, Alan Hall, who calls me salt and pepper, another promise kept, says that I will get into heaven if I just take the sacrament and pay my tithing. Well, I'm partway there. There are follies that I still observe in human members, leaders, and history of the church. I am not blind to these facts. If others were to judge the church by me, I would be an antichrist. I remember how I felt of always being judged, held to a measurement of being a model Mormon, to always look like I was doing things right. I also know how it feels to just be accepted and loved for me, a Christ-like love, unconditional. I have seen the light of Christ shine from people. I have seen a sacred promise kept. I have been prompted when to move, where to move, and God has not failed me. And I must not fail him on my promise to keep myself alive. And that is no small task for me at times. I have felt others' true concern and love for me, regardless of my level of church involvement. God only has each of us. Us who are here on this lone and barren world to lift each other up, to assist each other as we walk this deep path of suffering. The balance of the gospel is a stronger draw than the follies of the church, its members, and its leaders. But the gospel and its Christ-like members have brought me healing. I still find some members and even my mother irritating, which I guess is normal for a 90-year-old mother. But rigidness does not suit me. Thank you for hearing my story. Thank you, God, for your promise. I have never found myself alone. Without those who love me, understand me, and accept me unconditionally, and for all the humans who have helped heal me and will continue to help heal me. Thank you.
Well said, Carlene. Okay, can you hear me? Is this on? Oh. Should I use her? I'll use hers. You've all heard about my excommunication for 22 years now, but I'll try to share some new information today. My disciplinary council was really not my own. It was very public, out of my control, and became this rally cry for many thousands of people for 22 years. It's like, remember the Alamo, remember the September 6th. So I really haven't talked about my own experience within that whole bigger story, only a couple of times. My own personal narrative kind of got lost in the public narrative, and the public narrative, I have to say, was greatly oversimplified and didn't begin to comprehend the personal reality behind the headlines, behind the controversy, behind the conflict. I was actually in a different place than the other members of the September 6th because I had been completely inactive in the church for 10 years. So when my disciplinary council happened, I didn't feel harmed or upset or hurt inwardly. It did affect my social relationships and my path greatly, but there was a difference there. Why I was excommunicated is pretty simple. It's not because I published a feminist book, which is what everybody thinks, and which to some extent I thought at the time. I didn't know the whole story. The feminist book was why I was called in for interviews and for a disciplinary council, but it wasn't the reason that they excommunicated me. The reason that they excommunicated me was because we failed to hear and understand each other. There was a huge disconnect of fear and mistrust and defensiveness, so we were talking past each other. The reality of what really happened, at least for me, and I cannot speak for the other members of the September 6th and would not even want to, but the reality of what happened was far more complex. At the time, everybody was simplifying it. The church sort of saw me as the enemy, which I wasn't, and the media saw me as a victim, which I wasn't. I wasn't either the enemy or the victim. I didn't even know my whole story then, and I'm still unpacking what really happened today. As I'm sitting here at this panel, and as I was getting ready for it, I realized new things as I was typing up my notes about my own story. So I think it's important that we need to remember how complex these stories are and how complex the lives are of the people who are involved, and not oversimplify and not be unfair to any member or party of an excommunication. I want to go back and revisit a couple of things from 1993 that I've never shared in public. I knew from secondhand, from someone who talked to the people who knew, that high-level leaders were concerned about my book, and particularly Mike Quinn's article. In fact, I was told the book caused them heartburn, and there was concern that Mike's article had an intent to do harm to the church. And that wasn't our intent, but that was how they, a few church leaders, were feeling at that time. The church did want to meet with us, very much. And so the state president, who was the same state president for Michael and myself, we both had the same state president, who happened to be my cousin, wanted to meet with us in February and called to set up meetings with us. And then also in May, Elder Lauren Dunn, who was the area director underneath the 12, also wanted to meet with us very much and requested that we both come and meet with him. So the church really did want to meet with us and work with us, and that's not a story that you've heard. I went to those meetings. I went and met with the state president, and I also went in and met with Elder Dunn. Mike chose not to go to either one of those meetings, and
it?
You know, I really honored his decision. Mike and I were together. We were grouped together in discipline, but our paths were very different, and our relationships to the church were very different. He had a much longer relationship with those leaders, going back 10, 20 years to the 70s. I didn't. I was brand new on the scene. I'd never really interacted with them. And so Michael and I respected each other and the fact that we were in different places, even when we were going through our discipline. So that was important, that we have love and mutual respect for each other and understanding. Unfortunately, those conversations failed. And it's not entirely their fault, and it's not entirely my fault, but it was partly my fault. My conversations with the state president that year were very heated and defensive, and they gave me headaches, and we were arguing. We were not hearing each other. We were combative. My meeting and discussion with Elder Dunn did not go well. We were both defensive, and we got angrier and angrier, and we ended up yelling at each other. So you could say that meeting failed. And again, it was half my fault, mainly because I was in a position of defensiveness. And again, we just weren't hearing each other. We weren't finding common ground or connecting. It was a major disconnect. So I retreated, and I refused to cooperate from then on. I refused to cooperate with the state president. I refused to attend the disciplinary council. I refused to work with them. And so it was a failed relationship. We misjudged each other, and we missed out on the higher truth that enfolded us both. And so that higher truth of who we both were and our relationship was thwarted and distorted and misread. I want to jump ahead, kind of. I'm going to jump back and jump ahead. Fast forward 20 years later to 2013, after I came back to the church in 2012. Finally, in 2013, I wound up through synchronicity. I ran into my old state president who had excommunicated me in the temple. I was going through the temple for the second time, and he was there in the temple. And that's when we first saw each other for the first time in 20 years. And we both looked at each other and smiled, and we both started crying. There was no animosity. I mean, 20 years have gone by, exactly 20 years. So we made an appointment to get together and talk, and we finally had the conversation that we should have had in 1993, 20 years earlier. And I asked him point blank, I said, if I had come in and worked with you and attended the disciplinary council and cooperated to some degree, would you have excommunicated me? And he said, no. He said, the reason I felt I had no choice was because you wouldn't work with me, you wouldn't come talk, you wouldn't attend, you wouldn't come defend yourself, you wouldn't meet with us. And he had borne that pain for 20 years. He had felt the burden of a farmer when I did. I had gone on my way, and which I'll share in a minute, and found real healing and belonging, and he had really suffered over that for 20 years in a way that I hadn't. And so I let him know that he shouldn't feel that way, he shouldn't carry any burden at all, and that I told him I loved my time out of the church. I loved that 20 years. I had such an amazing journey, and God was with me every step of the way. And I can't tell you how much that meant to him. It lifted a burden for him. So that was 2013. That was the year after I came back to the church. In 2014, I wrote to Elder Packer, President Packer, because I thought we needed to have the conversation finally that we should have had 20 years before. You know, and as I think back, I could have written a letter to the apostles back in 1993. I mean, Elder Dunn did want to talk to us. I could have made the attempt through at least writing a letter to open a conversation, to find out, you know, to try to understand each other and clarify misunderstandings, but I didn't. I didn't try. So in 2013, I finally wrote a letter to President Packer and explained where my heart was back in 1993, that it was very sincere, and that the authors in the book, Women and Authority, were very sincere, and that we had no intent whatsoever to upset or harm the church, but that our research research was sincere and that we were really trying to bring forth information that we thought was important. And I also acknowledged that my approach back in 1993 had not been very sensitive, but had been defensive and combative. And I got a letter back from President Packer, which was very kind and complimentary, and which said that very briefly how much he appreciated my letter, and that he really appreciated the sincerity, and he understood what I was trying to say. And he complimented me and said, please know that for my part, I feel nothing but admiration for your path and your decisions. So I was so grateful that 20 years later, we were able to have that much conversation and communication. So much more went unknown, unsolved, unsaid. But I thank God that we got that much before President Packer died. There's so much more of the story we will never know. You know, we can complain and vent all we want for years in public, but until we really engage a relationship and renegotiate it and transform it, we aren't getting anywhere with that relationship. You have to actually work with the relationship, with the person that you're having the problem with. It's not about giving up or surrendering or conforming to somebody else's point of view, the church's point of view. It's about conflict resolution, pure and simple. I happen to be a trained certified mediator with the Utah Dispute Resolution in the courts. I used to mediate cases back in 2001 when I went through that training in 2002. And so I understand how conflict resolution works. In conflict resolution and mediation, you either solve the conflict or you don't. One side can't just simply dominate or invalidate or dismiss the other or exclude the other. It requires true resolution, requires both sides, both truths, both realities in conversation with each other, willing to understand each other and find common ground and work together. Now that's real power. It's not simple, it's not fake, it's real. And that's what I talk about when I talk about a collaborative approach to the church or to leaders. I'm talking about conflict resolution. I want to touch on a couple of other points. You know, after discipline and after an excommunication, where do you go? What do you do? When you're kicked out of the Mormon church, what do you do? I want to touch on a few points, things I learned along the way. You have to find a new spiritual home. You have to find a place where you belong, where you'll be accepted and appreciated and loved, because you can't be out there in the cold, you know, in alienation forever. It's not healthy. It's not good for you. You have to find a positive spiritual path, which I did. I found that through Gnostic communities and interfaith work and chaplaincy work at the Holy Cross Chapel. I also had to find peace and well-being on two levels. I had to find peace and well-being within myself, in my own soul. And then I had to find it outwardly with others. So I had to find peace about the church and my relationship, severed relationship with the church. Which I did, again, through my studies of Gnosticism and Gnostic clergy work, mainly, especially the notion of the kingdom of God within you, the Gnostic kingdom of God, the inner kingdom, your direct, unmediated connection to the divine. And that's where I found my refuge and my healing, through the doorway within my own soul to that kingdom of God and to God. On an outer level, I found peace and healing with the church accidentally through my work on the Interfaith Roundtable when I joined as an interfaith minister and chaplain. I joined the Interfaith Roundtable and wound up working with LDS leaders on interfaith projects. So I found a whole new relationship. So I had to find a positive project that I could work on with the church where we had the same goal, and that's what I found. And so in finding that healing, I think it really requires, again, a positive project where you really share a common goal. And I learned through that that, guess what, the leaders are human beings, and they were wonderful people, and I misjudged them, and we're all human beings, and they treated me wonderfully. Well, I remember my first interfaith roundtable meeting, I thought, I better sit by a non-Mormon, because the Mormon men here won't want me here. So I picked out a guy who I thought looked non-Mormon. He turned out to be the amazing, wonderful Steve Kohler, who was the president of the Missionary Training Center. He loved me, supported me, validated me, and treated me like gold, and just became my dear friend on the Interfaith Roundtable. And he was a big part of my healing, as were the other men. All the men I worked with on the roundtable were very, very healing for me. The other point I wanted to touch on about finding your healing and your peace is that you have to finally recognize your power. You know, half the reason why we're alienated and in conflict is that we think we're powerless, or we think the other person has all the power and we don't have any. And you have to finally see your power and own it. And what your power is the effect that you have on others, the ability that you have to affect others. And guess what? We all have that power. We affect each other far more than we realize we do, every single day. So you have to finally own your power, and then all of a sudden you don't have to try so hard. You don't have to yell or scream or hold up a sign. You realize, oh my gosh, I can walk into a room, and just by just my presence, just being here, I affect things. Carlene affects me. She's changed my life this week. Dawn affects me. One conversation can change a whole day for me. One conversation with Dawn. We affect each other. That's your power. Own it. Because you have a huge effect on people more than you realize. And if people are being defensive or antagonistic towards you, it's because they're feeling threatened. You've got more power over them than you realize, or at least they're giving you that power. Jumping ahead to why did I come back to the church? On that path, I had found my healing. I loved my path. I loved my time out of the church. Why did I come back? It manifested on its own. It had a life of its own, and it arose out of my healing and well-being. I realized through promptings of the Spirit that were unavoidable, undeniable, I needed to bring my journey full circle, that I had taken on this kind of karmic task of standing up for women's authority and standing up for women's ministry and women's history in the church. And that task was only half done. I needed to bring it home and complete that task and bring it full circle. And that was made known very clearly to me through a spiritual series of prayers and answers. I just knew that that's what I had to do, and there was no doubt about it. I will say that coming back to the church has been far harder than being outside. When I was outside of the church, I felt like, you know, in the movie with Sandra Bullock, Gravity, you know, she's out floating around in space. It's kind of wonderful and nice, and then she's trying to get back down to Earth. She just goes through so much, and she's getting beat up and thrown around, and coming back, honestly, coming back into the church and into the community has felt to me like sort of re-entering Earth's atmosphere. It's really been bumpy. It's been rough. And the difficulty has not been with the church. The difficulty I've encountered has been with our culture, and particularly our liberal dissenting culture, our culture of dissenters and critics. Because I'm in a different place now, and I'm taking a different approach to the church, and those who are in their place of antithesis and standing up to the church can't understand my position. They just don't understand it, and it doesn't make sense to them. And so, since I'm not at odds with the church right now, many of my friends and fellow liberals and feminists feel that I've somehow betrayed them and abandoned them. And there's a lot of pain there and mistrust. And so now I find myself in the opposite position of having a kind of a damaged relationship with my own people, my fellow liberals and critics and dissenters, that needs a lot of work and love. It's interesting. I've been perceived by them as somehow catering to the patriarchs or having betrayed feminism, or that I'm somehow afraid to speak the truth now, or that I'm inauthentic. And none of those things are true at all. It's the point is that I'm doing conflict resolution. I'm doing mediation. And so I have not abandoned my liberal, intellectual, feminist, critical side at all. The thing is, I'm seeing the other side, and I'm dealing with both. I'm seeing the side of the church that resonates as true and good, and that I find myself really in harmony with. And so both of those sides of me coexist and are working together. And I have not abandoned one. It's just that I'm seeing the whole picture now. Because if we only see what's wrong with the church, if we only see the bad, then we're not seeing the good. Just like those who only see the good and refuse to see the harms, the problems, the flaws, the, you know, all the bad stuff, they're not able to fix the problems. If you can't see the problems in the church, we're not going to be able to fix them. We all have to see those problems before we can fix them. But we also have to see the good and the stable and the empowering and the inspiring. We really need to see both. If we're only seeing one side or the other, we've got an imbalanced view. I think I'm probably almost out of time. I'm going to have to cut this short. You know, returning to the church doesn't mean that I agree with everything the church teaches or does. I don't. It means that I see the church as worthwhile and worth being part of, in spite of its flaws. I think it's unrealistic to say that you can't be part of an organization that has tragic flaws or misuses power, because every organization I've ever been in has tragic flaws and has members or leaders who misuse their power. So that's human nature. It's just the way it is. But we all are more than our pathology. Joseph Smith is far more than his pathology. The leaders, the critics, the members, the dissenters, we are all more than the worst things that we do. We are souls trying to know ourselves, and the church is trying to know itself. I've learned that there's not one true narrative. We can't just adopt one dominant narrative and say, this is it. There are many narratives that are simultaneous. We can't presume to own or speak each other's narrative. We can't impose our view of the church or our relationship with the church onto others. We have to accept others' own narrative and own relationship with the church. I think one of the biggest concerns I have, and one of the worst problems I see on all sides, from defenders of the faith and detractors or critics, is that there's a lot of transference. We tend to project our own view onto others, and we're not really allowing everybody the reality of their own experience. It is so important that we not presume to speak for others and presume to claim to know what their motives and their truth is. We need to accept their story at face value. And we need to speak our own truth to power. We need to speak our own experience, our own suffering, our own loss, our own pain, the problems we've experienced, and speak from our own situated knowledge, which is more powerful. One last thing I want to mention is that I think it's important for us to try to see the larger picture, the larger view. This is something that gives me my sense of stability and solidity, because I see that both the defenders of the faith and the dissenters are needed. They're both valid. They're both telling the truth. And I see that that the criticism and the conflict that we go through, you know, feminists and liberals and GLBTs, and those tensions and those eruptions and those disciplinary councils and those excommunications, they're unavoidable. They have to happen. Because Mormonism is an evolving religion with a religious personality. It has its own psyche. Mormonism is trying to know itself. And those of us who are doing the shadow work, the shadow of the psyche is the part of our personality or our self that we fear or we haven't seen or we're afraid to see, or the unknown. And that becomes the shadow. And so those of us who are engaged in shadow work, scholars and feminists and intellectuals, we're confronting and dealing with the shadow side, the side of the religion that people don't want to look at. And that has to happen. That's important work, and that's needed. So when these conflicts happen and when the disciplinary councils happen, it's actually a good thing. It's not all bad. There are a couple of really good things that come out of this. In 1993, feminists and scholars and liberals were a very tiny minority. And it was like this little backwater of Mormon culture. You know, the larger community and the media and the national community didn't know about any of that. So the disciplines and excommunications of 93 and all the media brought us all out of obscurity, made us all famous. Everybody suddenly knew about Mormon feminism and my book and Michael Quinn. And it brought Mormon feminism and scholarship and liberalism, these issues, out into a public level of knowledge and into a conversation with a larger world. That was a very good thing. And the same is true today. In the last year and a half with Kate Kelly and with John DeLynn and the Calderwoods, you know, it has its downside. It's really, really rough on people. But oh my gosh, it has communicated these issues to a national and a global audience, and it has taken the knowledge and the communication with between Mormons and non-Mormons. It's taken that information to a huge, huge global level. And also, back then we were a small minority. Today it's a critical mass of church members who are engaging these issues and talking about them. Those are good things. So it's not all bad. We don't need to wear sackcloth and ashes, and it's a really good thing. It's absolutely imperative for the growth and maturation of our religion. Mormonism is struggling to know itself. And some of those of us who have been groundbreakers and who have pushed the boundaries have had a rough time. But the good thing is, those conversations are happening on a level they never had before. And even the kinds of dialogue and conversation between the church and members and people who are dissenting are happening. The church and church PR and people who work for the church read every single blog. They read everything that all of us are saying out there. And so there's a level of communication today that is absolutely amazing and historic that I've never seen before. And so it's not all bad. There's some good news in there. And I think it's important that we hang in there and work with each other and understand, take the big picture, that we are all needed. Every one of you, Brock Waterman is needed. Kate Kelly and Donna Kelly, John DeLynn, the Calderwoods, we're all needed. We're all part of a bigger conversation, and you are heard. And even if you have to go out and be alone for a while, you're still part of the body of Christ, and it's not over yet.